This is Michael J. Fox. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation's work and how you can help speed a cure at michaeljfox.org.
You're listening to audio from a recent Q&A session with Foundation staff at an event in New York City. Listen to the full panel discussion in a separate podcast on our website and in your podcast app.
All right, let's move on to all of your questions, and thank you for providing so many. And here's a great one to start, and Marco, why don't you take this one, which is, please comment on the current state of the alpha-synuclein research trials. We talked about things that may lead to getting alpha-synuclein to clump up and create the Parkinson's problem, and related to that, everything from genetic problems to many others, inflammation that may cause set alpha-synuclein clumping in motion. But we also have a half a dozen or more trials out there, I think maybe it's almost 10, that are testing different ways of getting at those clumps of alpha-synuclein. Where are we with those trials?
Yeah, and when I tell people that we have a really robust and healthy therapeutic pipeline, it means two things. It means, one, the numbers, having almost 10 trials that are targeting alpha-synuclein is incredible. And then the second thing is the diversity, that all the different approaches that they're taking to target alpha-synuclein. Given how I mentioned before that the attrition rates are high, you want to make sure you got a lot of shots on goal, a lot of different approaches. And for alpha-synuclein, we see that in the pipeline. So for example, there are what's called biologics. A biologic just means that it's either a vaccine or it is an injection of an antibody to target LRRK2. Those are two different approaches within the biologics approach. There's a second approach called small molecules. The reason we call certain medicines small molecules is because drugs that are taken orally have to be quite small to be able to get through your blood-brain barrier. You have a barrier from your periphery to get it into your brain. It has to be small enough to get in. So there's a small molecule approach. All comes with different pros and cons versus the biologics. There's even a third approach that is percolating, which I'm sure will eventually get it into a clinical trial soon. It comes from the cancer work. It's called a PROTAC approach, where you're actually using the natural ability of your cells to degrade foreign entities, and it's called the proteasome, and utilizing that to destroy alpha-synuclein. So it's the number. There are a lot of trials out there, and the diversity, which I'm very excited about.
And some have advanced into phase two, none yet in phase three, which is the third stage of the clinical trial process. But that means fairly soon, once phase two are completed, and there are some that look promising enough to move into phase three, we'll have a notion, right, within the next 3 to 5 years as to whether or not one of these may actually work.
Yeah, exactly. And then to Suhini's point of de-risking, our investments in these early trials will then build a data package that is going to get larger companies with more potential for funding to then intervene, either buy those programs, and then take it into a phase three trial, which is a very expensive process.
Here's another question that connects in some ways to alpha-synuclein, Rachel, that maybe you can take. And the question is MJFF involved in any studies that look at gut bacteria and how that may relate to Parkinson's symptoms? There's been a tremendous amount of interest in this, the thought that maybe alpha-synuclein actually might start in the gut as opposed to the brain. And some of that is connected because of studies going way back that show this early connection between problems with constipation that may have to be connected to Parkinson's. So where are we with that? What do we know? What are we trying to find out?
Yeah, similar to inflammation, and there's a connection to inflammation, this is a tough one to tackle. So there is a connection between the gut and the brain for reasons you detailed. Constipation is a very common symptom in Parkinson's that happens often decades before the disease starts. So we know that the gut is involved in Parkinson's somehow, some way. We also see that protein, alpha-synuclein, that clumps in the brains of people with Parkinson's in the gut. So whether it starts in the gut and then spreads to the brain, or it starts in the gut and the brain at the same time, or it starts everywhere at the same time, that's yet to be determined. But we know it's there. We also know that the gut is our first interaction with the environment, right? That's how our diet is processed. So we know that pesticides are associated with Parkinson's disease. We know that diet is associated with Parkinson's disease. So there are many different connections and yet to be determined exactly how all those connections fit in. So there's a lot of work to be done here. The microbiome also is very large, lots of bacteria in the gut. So determining which are good, which are bad, how those change on a daily basis and how they change in Parkinson's is a tough thing to figure out. And so there's a lot of work to be done here.
Let's stay in that part of the anatomy for a moment because there's another question about diet recommendations, which always comes up. And people are interested in that, often for really good reasons, because blueberries are antioxidants, so that might play a role in inflammation and so forth. Are we any further in really knowing whether there is such a thing as a diet that would make sense for either people who have been diagnosed or who are at risk for being diagnosed?
Well, I mean, we kind of chuckle about the fact that we always get this question, but it's good that we get this question because people want to know what they can do and how they can live well and those sorts of things. And diet is a really hard one to study. I mean, similar to exercise, it's hard to control what people eat and know that they're following a specific diet and be very regimented on diets. Certain diets that have been studied in Parkinson's in very small studies, either they're very small controlled studies or there's no sort of like placebo group or control group, the ketogenic diet, the Mediterranean diet, which focuses on whole foods, fish, healthy fats like olive oils, the MIND diet, which is somewhat similar. And these have shown, the Mediterranean diet in particular has shown some association with a lower risk of Parkinson's in people who don't have Parkinson's. The ketogenic diet is a little bit conflicting. So the long story short is that we don't have solid evidence to support one specific diet over another for Parkinson's. Some people will say they eat a gluten-free diet, for example, and feel fantastic. Is that because they have something else going on? Is that because their Parkinson's is mild? We don't know. So I think the sort of party line is to eat a healthy, balanced diet, eat a lot of fruits, eat a lot of vegetables, which have antioxidants we know are good for you, eat whole grains rather than sugary, processed American-type diet, follow the perimeter of the store and eat whole, unprocessed foods, and eat as healthfully as possible. As far as whether you want to try one particular diet over another, I think that's an individual conversation to discuss with your doctor and a dietitian if you have access to one.
And by the way, after we're done today, we'll see how well the Michael J. Fox Foundation practices what it preaches by what's offered in the box lunches.
And don't hold me personally to that. I have nothing to do with those.
So if there are no blueberries, you can report that. Anyway, there are box lunches. You can pick them up after we're done, and we'll have our kind of networking informal lunch afterward. Here's a question that I think speaks to how the field continues to evolve. It's a question about stem cells and where we are with them. 10 years ago, that would have been front and center in where we think everything's gonna go in right. terms of fixing Parkinson's disease. Then there were bumps and problems and it became less a topic. Now there's kind of a little bit more interest again, as well as clear kind of warnings to not sort of go by the latest stem cell treatment being offered in some other country because that hasn't been proven yet. Lots going on. Marco, bring us up to date.
Yeah, and in a similar way to what's happening with alpha-synuclein and targeting that protein, there's a lot of innovation that's happened with stem cells, and it used to be very politically charged discussion, and there's been a lot of new science that has kind of moved it away from that. For example, there's something called iPS cells or induced pluripotent cells. So there's discoveries that were made, Nobel Prizes were given out for this, in which you can actually take a adult human cell and add a chemical cocktail to it so that you revert that cell back to a embryonic stage, even though it's not an embryonic cell, that then can differentiate, it can then become, for example, a dopaminergic cell. There's a small trial that's happening in Japan that's very exciting that new science got quickly translated into a clinical trial. There's other ways of taking egg cells and shocking the egg cell so that all the chromosomes stay in that egg cell. And that's a completely different stem cell approach. So just like with alpha-synuclein, they have the biologic class, a small molecule class. You got more shots on goal with different approaches. That's actually happening with stem cells also, which is exciting.
Go ahead, Richard.
I was just going to add on to that. So I think this is exciting. A lot of people ask about it. It's a novel way and a different route to potentially replace those dopamine cells that go missing in Parkinson's. But a couple sort of caveats on it. One is that we don't know that this would be a, you know, disease modifying or cure for Parkinson's. You know, potentially it could really help with the movement symptoms and decrease your need for medication for long periods of time. But because we don't know the cause and the underlying effect of the disease, could that take over eventually? And could you eventually need medication again, or could it stop working? So these are the things that we need to figure out. Also, the stem cell trials that are ongoing and anticipated, these actually make dopamine cells out of iPSCs, like Marco was talking about, and they implant them into the brain. This is very different from the stem cell clinics that you hear about touting, you know, the cure for Parkinson's, arthritis, diabetes, on and on and on, for potentially thousands of dollars. Some people do pursue that as an avenue of therapy, but that has not been proven, and that is not a clinical trial. So just, you know, be wary if you think about those sort of stem cell clinics and discuss those with your personal physician if that's something you're thinking about.
Yeah, really key point. There are a lot of snake oil salesmen out there, and it's something I think we all have to be mindful of. Marco mentioned a moment ago when he was talking about the variety of stem cell approaches, he used the phrase shots on goal. It is impossible to get through any Michael J. Fox Foundation meeting without hearing the phrase shots on goal. And as someone noted yesterday in our patient council meeting, I'm from Texas. I have no idea what shots on goal is.
I'm from Canada.
Just let's take just a quick side detour on that phrase. I don't know whether Debbie Brooks came up with that or where that actually came from.
I think it was Michael, actually.
Okay. Well, another Canadian. but that means really that that phrase is there for a reason, because we want to have a lot of possibilities out there, because you don't know which one is going to actually get by the goalie and into the net.
Exactly. I think that's one of the unique roles that the foundation plays when we think about the whole field of Parkinson's research, is we're not wedded to one particular idea. We exist to be able to support the best science and the best approaches. And I think one of the things that we've learned, particularly looking at other fields, is that there's a real danger in assuming that one approach is the right approach. And I think all of you have seen in the news lately that there's a lot of negative information coming out about some of these Alzheimer's trials, who all tackled the same sort of protein in this very similar manner. And one of the lessons learned is that there was a lot of really, really good science supporting going after Alzheimer's in this way, but it didn't pan out, it seems like. And it doesn't mean it may not in the future, but right now it's not panning out. And I think our role as a foundation is to make sure that we constantly have a pipeline of new approaches and new ways of tackling Parkinson's disease, and making sure that those are all being pushed forward, because we still, unfortunately, there are a lot of unknowns about PD. And so we don't have that surety of being able to say, this is the one that's going to get into the goal. Rather, we want to have as many chances of getting that one into the goal.
Question about genetics and genetic testing, another really interesting and challenging question that I think confronts many families. So it's a two-part question. Where can I get genetic testing for free? And if I have a family history, is my risk actually higher? So why don't you take the last part first, and then maybe you can speak to the 23andMe partnership, Sohini. But on the question of if I have a family history of Parkinson's, is my risk higher? And the kind of counseling that someone might want to consider before actually even taking a genetic test.
Yeah, so the answer is I'm not sure, and not necessarily. Just because you have a family member with Parkinson's disease, if they developed Parkinson's at, you know, the average age of onset of 60, you know, 58, 60, maybe not. You know, your increase is maybe about, you know, the average increase, the average risk of Parkinson's for the general population is about 1% for everybody, family member or not. Maybe your risk increases about 3% if you have a family member. I don't know how much that would increase if you have a genetic component. So there's a lot of nuance in here, whether your family member is a little bit younger, it might be higher. If they have a genetic risk factor that you then maybe inherit, it could be a little bit higher. So that's where I think genetic counseling comes in and is really important and can be really helpful, because genetic counselors are experts in this, and they can help detail, set out a whole family tree for you that says, Dad had Parkinson's, mom didn't, my brother didn't had it, you know, I am not sure if I do, you know, these sorts of things, and detail the whole thing and say, this is what I think your potential risk is before we go into testing. Here's all the things you should think about that genetic testing can and can't tell you before you even have the genetic testing. And then when you get your results, they can go over them with you and tell you what they do and don't mean. Because I think that's a really hard thing for a lot of people to swallow, is getting these results back and saying, I don't know what this means. And then sometimes even taking them to your doctor who says, I'm not sure even what they mean. So having that sort of conversation and open discussion even before you have testing, again, about what it can and can't tell you and what it means for you or potentially means for you and your family is really important.
So I think a great point, because if you just take the numbers Rachel just mentioned, that the overall population has 1%. If you have a family member, maybe it goes up just one family member as opposed to several, because then the odds do change. If you have just one, maybe it goes up to 3%, that's still, you know, 3 out of 100. So it's not so much. But depending on how that report is, how that result is reported to you, if you get something from a genetic test that says you have 3 times the chances of getting Parkinson's, it sounds terrible, right? But maybe that's just 1% to 3%. That's 3 times.
Yeah,
it's really important to have that sense.
Yeah, it is. And I know it's a scary thing, but it's really important to note that there are no mutations that are associated with Parkinson's that guarantee that you're going to get Parkinson's disease. If you find that, that's called complete penetrance. And none of these genetic causes of the disease have complete penetrance. They're all incomplete penetrance. So it increases the probability. It's why biomarkers are so important, because that alone can't explain if you're going to get Parkinson's or not. There needs to be something else that's contributing to it.
Great context for us to have. And just briefly, Sohini, then, though, speak to the partnership that the foundation does have with 23andMe and the role that that's played in developing, getting more data from people who have those genetic risk factors.
Sure. So I might take one step back. How many here have heard of Fox Insight? Oh my God, awesome, that's great. So then I don't have to say very much other than Fox Insight is an online study that the foundation sponsors, and it's sort of a complement to PPMI, where PPMI focuses on a very small population and goes very deep in trying to understand the disease through objective ways, clinical scales, sample collection, imaging, et cetera. Fox Insight is about trying to get information from Parkinson's patients in particular, but also others, about the lived experience of the disease. And one of the unique things that we have within Fox Insight is a collaboration with the personal genetics testing company 23andMe. So if you are a Parkinson's patient and you are enrolled in Fox Insight, you have the ability to participate in the genetic component of Fox Insight that is enabled by 23andMe. You get their personal genome kit at no cost, and you're able to get your genetic testing done. One of the things the foundation offers through this approach is genetic counseling. So if you opt in to do this genetic component of Fox Insight, you will also be given information about how you can then have counseling sessions with the group who actually performs genetic counseling for our PPMI participants.
And an exciting thing now is that if you were to find out that you are a mutation carrier, that there are actually trials now out there. I mean, it's one thing to get information and not have any next step, but there is a potential next step.
And I would also add that for those that may not want to go down that route, because there is so much research focused on genetics, genetic testing is often now offered as part of many research opportunities. So going on to Fox Trial Finder will give you a great way of seeing what genetic research is occurring and whether you can get genetically tested and receive that information through that mechanism.
We just have a few minutes left before we get to discover what the foundation has in mind for your box lunches. So we're going to try to get through. We're not going to get through all of your questions. They're great questions. Really smart group here today. Really great questions. But I want to try to get through three or four more. So this is sort of lightning round style, if you would. Rachel, can you use the Imbrija, the inhaled new form of levodopa carbidopa, for an off episode? Can you use that if you're not using carbidopa levodopa yet?
That's a great question. So you always use levodopa in combination with a medication called carbidopa. So you're used to getting Sinemet or Rytary or Stalevo, and that's always levodopa combined with carbidopa. And that's because the carbidopa stops levodopa from being broken down before it gets to the brain. So the answer is most likely not, because if you take that levodopa, it's gonna just be lost and get broken down before it gets to the brain, where it's converted to dopamine. So the answer would be, I mean, maybe there are ways around it. You can take some extra carbidopa or that sort of thing, but it's intended to be used in addition to your regular medications, which include Sinemet and carbidopa, levodopa.
Question about environmental pesticides. You mentioned earlier, Marco, that we still don't know, outside of the genetic things that put you at risk for Parkinson's, what else may cause Parkinson's. But there's been lots and lots of research over the years that have led us to believe that the environment probably plays a role, and that pesticide exposure in particular is something that puts people at higher risk, certainly for Parkinson's, even though we're not sure if it's causation or association. So what can you tell us about what we know now about the role of pesticides? How close are we to making that connection firm?
Yeah, I mean, the working model right now of what we have of the cause of Parkinson's is that it falls on a spectrum. And on one extreme end of the spectrum, we know that there are genetic causes of the disease. On the other end of the extreme spectrum, we know that there are chemicals and toxins in the environment that can cause the disease. We actually use those toxins quite a bit in a lot of the laboratory research to test drugs before they go into humans. And then there's a lot of unknowns. So that's part of what we're trying to do, is we're trying to fill up that spectrum so that we fully understand, but we try to take a holistic approach, and we understand it's not all about genetics, it's not all about the toxins in the environment, but there's probably some type of combination of factors that makes someone susceptible to Parkinson's disease.
I'm going to take two more of your questions, because these are really good questions about symptomatic issues, and then I want to pose a last question to our panelists. Rachel, who are the best candidates for DBS? This person would like to know.
So right now, DBS is approved for people who've had Parkinson's for at least 4 years and have motor fluctuations, which means that your symptoms fluctuate. You are on and your symptoms are well controlled, and then you go off and your symptoms are not well controlled, and that kind of fluctuation happens on and off throughout the day. And or you have dyskinesia, which is that involuntary, uncontrolled movement that can happen with taking levodopa for longer periods of time and having Parkinson's for longer periods of time. The best candidate for Parkinson's is typically a person who gets a good response to medication but has those complications. So you take your medication and your symptoms are well controlled, but you have these ups and downs or dyskinesia that can't be controlled well with adjustments to your medication. So DBS can typically give you your best day with medication with much less medication. The exception to that is people who don't respond, their tremor doesn't respond to medication. DBS can still be used pretty well in that instance. The people who aren't great candidates for DBS or people who don't get a good response to their medication are having extra non-movement symptoms, like a lot of cognitive problems, which can get worse with DBS, or a lot of speech and swallowing problems, or a lot of balance problems, which typically don't respond to the treatment.
And one last question that I think probably has occurred to many people here, and has to do with another difficult symptom that can happen late in Parkinson's disease connected to these cognitive issues, and that's the experience of having delusions and hallucinations. So new drug approved, I guess, a little more than a year ago, Rachel, Nuplazid, which has been helpful to many people. Many people have also commented on the commercials that I'm sure many of you have seen as being a little scary, and this question references that. The commercial says 50% of us will get hallucinations or delusions. Is that true?
That's a hard one. So I think it's up to 50% of people can have hallucinations or delusions. So hallucinations are seeing things that aren't there. You can also have tactile hallucinations, feeling things or hearing things that aren't there. But in Parkinson's, they're most often visual hallucinations. Delusions are believing things that aren't true. Often these are paranoid, so people will typically believe that a spouse is cheating on them or family members are taking money from them and things like that. Hallucinations and delusions do not happen in everybody with Parkinson's. If they do happen, they're typically later in the course of disease, and often they're associated with cognitive problems. So just like in people with Alzheimer's who have significant dementia or memory problems, they tend to come along with those other problems. So it's a little bit of a more difficult situation because they're compounding memory and thinking problems that are already there, but they're typically associated with significant cognitive problem if that's there.
And in a way, speak back to some of the things we've all been talking about. As we learn more, as we get through this data more clearly, we'll have a better sense who may be at risk for that particular symptom, as opposed to it just being a generalized statement, half of all people.
Exactly. And as you mentioned before, there are treatments for it. You know, there was a medication, Nuplazid, that was approved in 2016, which works in a new way to treat these. And there are other medications that we used before Nuplazid that we still use now. So there are ways to treat this.
Let me just pose the last question to all of you. And I want to ask you each sort of what you see as the biggest challenge facing the field and the foundation in our pursuit of stopping Parkinson's and even preventing it before it even begins. What's the challenge that you think about the most? But also what inspires you the most to confront that challenge and keep your shoulder to the wheel in this work? Marco, start us out.
So I think the biggest challenge, and I mentioned before, with drug discovery being so slow, and that I think a big part of our role is to speed it up. I think that's a huge challenge. And we speed it up by helping with recruitment. We speed it up by funding the best science, both preclinically and in the clinic. So I see that as the biggest challenge. What I'm very excited about is I feel that our community is growing, a community of patients that are getting more engaged in doing clinical research, a community of researchers, as I mentioned before, who never were interested in Parkinson's disease, and now they're all in. I'm very excited about that, and I think that will help address the challenge of the slow process of drug discovery.
Rachel.
Those are tough questions, Dave. I think the biggest challenge, or one of the biggest challenges, is understanding all of the nuances of Parkinson's. And it's the classic, the more we learn, the more we realize we don't understand. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we answer one question and there are five more waiting to be answered. And so I think that's the biggest challenge. We've come so far in our understanding, but we do have a long way to go. But we're chipping away at it for sure. And I think the thing that inspires and motivates me the most is really the people and the different personal stories that I hear. So whether it's, you know, somebody's struggle with their freezing, or I see them freezing and I think that makes me really want to get something better for that person. Or it's one of the fellows who we just graduated who I think, gosh, you know, what have I done with my life? Because they just graduated and they're establishing a clinic to treat patients and get them into research where a clinic never existed. So, you know,
Montana.
Okay, I'll work on it. But to see, you know, how high that bar is set, and that we just continue to need to reach higher and farther.
Sohini, bring us home here on challenge and inspiration.
The pressure. I think for me, the challenge, the thing that keeps me up at night, is what we can't control. So I know we have an amazing team. I know we have an amazing community. And I know we're making a lot of advances. What keeps me up at night is the things that we can't control, like the fact that there are so many failures in Alzheimer's. Is that going to have an impact on federal funding for neuroscience, on pharmaceuticals' appetite for risk? You know, those things where we can't really control, but it has a really significant impact on what's going on. And so those are the challenges that, you know, I really think about and I worry about. It doesn't mean that I don't think we have strategies for offsetting it, but they're harder to tackle because they're not within our control. That being said, if you flip to the positive, the thing that really inspires me, it actually It's so interesting that you asked this question, because maybe I would have had a different answer a few months ago. But I was recently at a birthday party. My son's 4 years old, so it was a four-year-old birthday party. Woohoo! And we were talking, and I was talking to some of the parents, and I do a lot of travel, and next week I'm actually going to be gone for most of the week for some work travel. And we were just talking about it, and about the impact on the family, et cetera. And my son was there, and as those of you know, kids at that age listen to everything. They don't necessarily understand it. But at some point, there was a question about, how does he take it? How does my son take it? And he sort of piped up and he said, "It's hard. I'm sad when mommy goes." And then he kind of paused and he said, "But mommy does good." And that's actually what inspired me, because especially in this age where discourse is so negative and so ugly, it's really inspiring to know that what I'm doing is setting a model for my son that it's important to do good, however good is done. And I do feel that we at the foundation are really focused on doing good.
Let's give one more round of applause to three people doing good.
This is Michael J. Fox. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation's work and how you can help speed a cure at michaeljfox.org.